Sam Fry presents The Dongle of Donald Trefusis, Episode 2, Landscape and Portrait, or Dead Men Don't Tweet, written and read by Stephen Fry. How does Charles Dickens's A Christmas Carol begin? Marley was dead, to begin with. There is no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Yes, well, I can say the same of Trefusis. Trefusis was dead. I'll go further. Trefusis is dead. Let there be no doubt about it. Dead and buried. Beneath the sod. There are all kinds of things dead men don't do. They don't make chutney, for example. They don't knit. They don't play basketball. They don't hang wallpaper. Steve Martin reminds us that they don't wear plaid either. And in American gangster movies, dead men don't talk. Dead men do not talk. And surely that means dead men don't chat. You'll never find a dead man in a chat room, surely. And dead men don't tweet. You won't find dead men on Twitter, will you? And yet... So many certainties on which I believed I could rely have been upset of late. I remember once hearing the story that there had been found amongst Ludwig Wittgenstein's papers the following summation of a lifetime's rigorous intellectual inquiry and restless metaphysical investigation. All things pass, all flesh is grass, life is balls, and death is arse. Professors Anscombe and Geach, the guardians of Wittgenstein's holy flame, hushed up this discovery, of course, believing it would harm the great philosopher's reputation. Trefusis, who knew Wittgenstein well back in the old days, prized the thought highly. It had, he argued, the kind of simplicity and directness for which we all should strive. Well, the second part of Wittgenstein's doggerel, "All flesh is grass," a quotation from Isaiah, I think, is certainly true. We are all as grass before the unforgiving scythe of death. Trefusis was himself duly mown down in 2008 at the age of 87. I'm Stephen Fry. I spend my time to-ing and fro-ing, this-ing and that-ing, what-ing and witching, popping up here, piping up there. Hard to avoid me sometimes, try as many might. I was away in, Madagascar, I think it was, when news came to me of Trefusis's death. It came as an even greater shock some months after my return to find myself named as a beneficiary in his characteristically idiosyncratic will. He bequeathed me his books, an achingly perfect collection, and his papers, a term that now legally embraces, such have been the advances of our age, digital phenomena such as the memory stick I found amongst his possessions, a storage device that is often called, rightly or wrongly, it's not for me to say, a dongle. Trefusis himself would doubtless maintain that we should let practice be our legislator and usage our lexicographer. So a dongle it is. I am now the owner of Trefusis's dongle, and it is my duty, it seems, to share with you its vexing, perplexing contents. But before I run hopelessly ahead of myself, you should know, if you don't already, that Dr. Donald Cornwallis Treadway Trefusis was Professor of Comparative Philology, extraordinary fellow of his college, and my teacher, my mentor, my nestor, my fidus Achates, my guide, philosopher, and friend. That he had worked as a codebreaker in the early days of Bletchley Park during the Second World War is well known. I personally gleaned from him that later in the war, he also saw action in Europe as part of his affiliation with the Secret Service, though with which branch I was always uncertain, and there was even talk of his connection to the notorious Cambridge spies, whose betrayals to Soviet Russia were, of course, the great scandal of the age. Donald Trefusis was a complex, and I cannot palter with it, often infuriating man. His prodigious memory and incisive intellect ranged as freely in the real and contemporary world as it did in the landscape of the human mind and the galaxy of thought. An almost unparalleled gift for languages was his most obvious accomplishment. He spoke in over a score and wrote in dozens more. For a large part of the 3 years of my student life, I would make the short walk along the backs of the colleges from Queen's to St. Matthew's, bang on the outer oak door of his rooms, and await the singing, "Come," or "Avanti," or "Herein," or "Sisan," or "Yuyun Bay," or "Tulgasis," or "Sirakan Masuk," depending on whether his mood that morning was English, Italian, German, Finnish, Hungarian, Estonian, Indonesian, or whatever it might have been. Then would follow an amazing kind of journey in which he would take me effortlessly on those boundless time and space travels of the mind that were for him like a walk to the corner shop. His eccentricities, oddities, episodes of impatience, disrespect, and even rudeness were, to my mind, all excused by his one truly great and marvellous gift, a gift more remarkable even than his almost unprecedented fluency in so many languages. He was born to be a teacher, a communicator, one who could make a narrative out of learning and a drama out of thought. When he spoke, history, art, science, literature, language, all the modern muses came alive on their hilltop and danced before the enchanted listener. He was never impatient with ignorance, only with apathy. He lit fires in the mind, fires that chased one another across the past and into the future, fires that lit, fires that linked, and fires that warmed. Well, enough to say that when I first fitted the dongle, for we shall call it that, into a suitable socket just a few weeks ago, I was presented with a bewildering collection of documents in all sorts of formats. At first I thought I had seen only sound files, but folders within folders revealed much more. "Listen to me first, .mp3, brought his voice to me.
"Hello, Stephen. It's been quite a time, hasn't it? Your old friend, if I might be permitted the term, Donald Trefusis here. Speaking to you, oh, how I have longed to be able to say this, from beyond the grave. Which is to say, I am dead, quite dead. Now listen to me. Listen to me. There is something you have to do. There are connections to be made, bridges to be built, chasms to be spanned, torrents to be forded. All my life I have collected greedily, through word and deed, through study and action, through observation of the world and participation in it. I have had the privilege of seeing much and meeting many. More importantly, at least in my own view, I have been fortunate enough to hold down a teaching post at this university. There have passed into these rooms for instruction many brilliant men and women, many of average attainments, and quite as many dullards and simpletons. And, of course, there has passed you, Stephen. I will not spare your blushes by denying that you have been a grievous disappointment to me, a glib, trite mind allied to an idiot, indolent propensity always to find the shortest distance between two points and then to attempt to shortcut even that. There was enough good stuff in you to have made an adequate scholar or even a passable teacher, but no, you preferred to mortgage your soul for title to that showy palace of fame and fortune whose vulgar towers, banners, and battlements loom over all that is worthwhile in this glozing world. So be it. At least from its arrogantly high rooftops and by virtue of its brassy heralds, you can be easily heard. Yes, you can be heard. That is the point. And so, young Stephen Fry, you shoddy, shabby bundle of specious and superficial...
There's a fair quantity of tedious waffle at this point, and I'll spare you some of the more uninteresting rantings of an elderly curmudgeon. I can scrub forwards here.
Vain, inglorious, conceited, complacent, falsely modest...
Yeah, well, while the poor old fellow was closer to 90 than to 80, he was bound to ramble and rave.
And yet, for all your excruciating, egregious and embarrassing faults, I can see that they are feelings in every respect typical of your generation, a generation that continues to mistake show for style, style for culture, and culture for art, to mistake appetite for passion and passion for insight, to mistake desire for intention and intention for achievement, to mistake fantasy for imagination and imagination for thought. In short, a generation of infantile fantasists. Nonetheless, Nonetheless, Stephen, you have access to the porches of the world's ears, and that is enough for my purposes. I hope that what I need you to do will become apparent. I am sending you, and through you I am sending all who may care, on a journey. Like many such journeys, the destination, the prize, is the purpose. And what a prize it is. But perhaps, like all important quests, it is the journey itself that will reveal itself to be of the greatest value of all. Oh, but the prize! I know you, Stephen. You and the child you will always be. The prize, the prize! You are all but bouncing up and down to know. What will I win? Will it be valuable? What is it? What is it? If you knew that, you would shortcut your way to it, thinking yourself an Alexander slashing a Gordian knot, and forgetting that Alexander was an unhappy failure and the enemy of civilization. By the way, Alexander died in a house called Balmuto. That may be important. Now, let me attempt to put it all in terms that you will understand. Behold, the quest. There is but one path to the prize, one golden key to unlock the great riddle. Those who second guess will miss. The journey is everything, and yet the journey is but the path to the prize, a path that cannot be shortcut. The prize is everything. The journey is everything. Only those who listen and look with open ears and eyes will know. How can this be? What is the prize? Only the journey can tell. What is the journey? It is the path to the prize.
He really can be a most aggravating man, Trefusis. There follows more in this vein that I shall hurry through.
Those who know what the prize is will find the prize no longer is. No one is the prize, yet no one is the path. The prize is not the path, nor the path the prize. Only through the path can the prize be seen. The prize is invisible to all but the eyes of those who have taken the path. No prize was ever more worth its path, no path its prize. Surprise, enterprise, the prize. I hope, Stephen, that this is clear to the meanest intelligence, even to yours. Well, they have a saying in China.
The journey of 1,000 miles begins with the purchase of one ticket. Let the journey begin. I want you to look at this picture.
Visit stephenfry.com/painting1.
And while you do, I will continue talking. Perhaps you know the work, perhaps you do not. Walter Scott was invited to inspect it in 1829. To whom had it belonged? That is one question I want you to answer, but first gaze at it. Some have held it to be a masterpiece of its kind. I know you, Stephen. I know you all too well. If you think a painting is a masterpiece, you will want an explanation, a key. Why is it so rated? What am I missing? Suppose I hate it. Suppose I don't get it. If I don't get it, does that make me a Philistine or someone falsely and self-consciously striving to show originality of mind? Somewhere between the worship of high art and the mocking of the emperor's new clothes, there must be a happy space in which one can enjoy pictures without writhing in agonies of self-aware embarrassment. Help, help, help. Yes, it is very difficult to look with innocent eyes at a painting. Especially easy when confronted by the contemporary to be angry, scornful, distrustful, skeptical, and highly alert to having the wool pulled over the eyes. But this before us is surely not a modern work of art. I've already told you that Sir Walter Scott, author of The Antiquary, amongst so many other novels and poems, looked at it in 1829. It was already old enough by then, let me assure you. Scott told the Duke of Buccleuch on that occasion that it was the kind of painting that would appeal more to an artist than to a nobleman. The figure in the centre of the picture, of the sportsman with his Spanish pointer, might make it pleasing to your grace, Sir Walter said, or words to that effect, but otherwise it is more suited to a painter's studio. I must say, when I stood in front of this painting as a child, having been taken to the gallery that now houses it by my Aunt Violet, I did not particularly notice either the shooter or his gun dog, much less know that the animal was a Spanish pointer, a breed with which I am not familiar. But I hope, while listening to my voice, you might be in a position that allows you still to be gazing at this landscape. I called it a work of art earlier. Perhaps that was precipitate of me. Perhaps you hate it, find no virtue in it at all. Perhaps you loathe talk of art. For many, Britons especially, to us, the word art is an embarrassment. Even to say it is a bit like shouting cock in church. Over a British dinner table, the word can hang like a fart. Only healthy talk of sport and reality TV can dispel it. Art is snob elitism and nothing more. So some would like to believe, and Yet how great the curiosity and hunger for art there is in the world. Never have more people gone to galleries and exhibitions. There is a great appetite for real nutrition for the spirit. But oh, the embarrassment and terror of standing before a painting. What does one say? What does one think? Are we supposed to look for some element in the composition or coloration and then comment on it? I like the perspective. I like how the muddy roadway seems almost roughly sketched and so on and so on. How banal that sounds. Maybe one should ask questions. What is that man on the right doing? Are they hops he is working on? Young trees? And what are the main trees that recede away? Are they elms? And why should any of this matter, you might wonder? This is an ancient piece of painting done at a time before digital cameras and Google Earth, so what is the purpose of our now venerating it? We have no need of recording landscape this way. It is historically interesting, perhaps, but does it tell us anything about the world? Does it comfort us, inspirit us, give us pleasure? Why the hell should we care? The days of art with a capital A are over. It's all pretentious nonsense of no value. It's showing off. It's old-fashioned. It's irrelevant. It's a waste of time. Oh, dear, I hear all those hostile voices in my head telling me that simply by expressing an interest in a painting, I'm somehow an enemy of real people and the real world, that I'm out of touch. And yet I can't stop looking at that painting. I remember looking at it as a boy, and I'm looking at a postcard of it now as I speak. It draws me in, it compels me. And perhaps one of you looking at it now, one of you to whom Stephen is blog-twitting or pad-costing or whatever it's called, perhaps one of you will be arrested by it. Perhaps it will make you smile and make you feel connected to something that matters. Ah, but then you see, I have special extra reasons for loving this painting. At some time during the war, I was landed on the coast of continental Europe. There was special and unpleasant work to be done. I shan't weary you with the details. I could only move by night, and found myself in moonlight in the very spot the painter had painted all those years ago. It was only a few miles from my beach landing, and how unchanged the scene was. I could not believe it. In all the horror of war and occupation and savagery and sabotage and subterfuge, in all that crucible of misery, cruelty, and bestial violence, I found myself standing in that very alley of trees, looking towards that very church. I hope you will forgive me if I say that this was the moment I knew that the war could not and would not end everything. The moonstruck beauty and quiet of this so very ordinary place and its connection with a beautiful painting that I had stood in front of as a small child, they spoke quietly to me of a might, imponderably greater than the brutal mechanized power that was bent on destroying everything this painting represented. Well, I'm allowed to be sentimental and to weep a little at my age. Whether or not the real landscape it represents now exists, perhaps one of the reasons I love this painting so well is that it has not changed when so much else around me has. My friends are nearly all rotted bones beneath the ground, or drooling valetudinarians like me who can barely make it to the lavatory in time and when they can have forgotten why they wanted to get there in the first place. But this still moment, made of paint and memory, has endured, and each time I return to look again it takes on greater beauty and power than ever before, until I find that even the thought of it makes me catch my breath. Perhaps this painting enriches me because when I first saw it, I was ready to be impassioned and enthused by a work of art, and this just happened to be the one. I'm not so sure. There were hundreds of other paintings in that same gallery, and yet, well, it is not important. It is only important that you look, that you allow yourself to look. You are probably wondering if there is some key in the painting which will lead you to your prize. You are already greedily attempting to find gain from the picture. Well, there is gain to be had from it, from looking. You will not notice at first, for you may well be looking for something inside the work, for meaning or context or for some clue, but try not to look for something. Try simply to look. Allow your gaze to wander freely while I talk. The next time you see the painting, whether it is tomorrow or a year hence, there will be a little stab of something like love in your heart. The picture will have buried itself deep inside you. It will have become a kind of friend. Or not. For perhaps you dislike it. Perhaps it does nothing for you. That is not a crime, nor a shortcoming in you. How can it be? On the other hand, what can be more objectionable than someone professing to dislike something that is generally prized because it makes them sound astute, discriminating, and self-possessed? All a picture asks is honesty. So simple. And yet in a world of status, snobbery, doubt, fear, and self-consciousness, honesty is just about the hardest thing that can be asked of any of us. Ask me what I should think, ask me what I ought to believe, ask me to repeat what sounds good and true, and I will happily respond. But what I truly, deeply feel? Oh, that is far too difficult. Anyway, I really must chat up. It's intolerable how I go on so. Age can excuse many things, but not everything. Look as long as you like on this 40¾-inch by 55½-inch oil landscape on canvas. I hope that you are pleased to have been introduced to this work, if you did not know it before. If you did already know it, as well you might have, for it is a celebrated work, well then, I hope you have been pleased to renew your acquaintance. And I hope, too, that in either case, you will avail yourself of the opportunity to stand before the real thing when next you are in the area. However so much as how that might be notwithstanding, let me now conduct you to another picture.
Visit stephenfry.com/painting2.
Here, look at this face. You may very well know it or guess it. Surely the quill pen betokens a writer. Funnily enough, history has ordained that this portrait should hang just around the corner from where the landscape we have been looking at also now hangs. How is the life of this man connected to the provenance of that landscape, I wonder? There is a connection. An antiquary. Not Jonathan Oldbuck, Scott's antiquary, but another. He is intimately connected to the life of the man in the portrait. The heights above the torrent, I don't know how good your Gaelic is, can be found some miles to the west of Kirkcaldy, and there a tragic scene was acted out that might help you find that connection. The place is important for great general reasons that will become apparent over the course of the journey. Oh, how cryptic it all seems! I am aware, young Stephen, that this may be difficult for you. Perhaps you will need assistance. I have tried to make my puzzle less susceptible to a simple Googie or Wickle search than I dare say you would like. You're so used to typing into a search bar without thinking. Well, it may be that a Googie or a Wickle search bar will help you this time, but not, I venture to suggest, without thought. If nothing else transpires, you will have looked at two pleasant pictures and thought about the business of looking and chased a few geese, some wild, some perhaps tame. But because this first puzzle, this first clue of your treasure hunt, this first step on the path to the prize is difficult, it may be that I will be able to help you by throwing out a hint or two from time to time. When people died a century ago, at the height of the spiritualist fever that gripped the world, they often promised to return by way of the medium's séance. Well, how would it be, young Stephen, if I promised to return by contacting you through the medium that now dominates your world? Not a fraudulent table-tapping cheat with an acquired foreign name, but through the channels of your favoured means of communication, Twitter. I have bagged myself a Twitter identity, and my spirit shall attempt to communicate with your followers through that portal. It may be that I can help guide those who are following the path to the prize this way. They can ask me for help and perhaps raise my dead spirit to answer.
Well, you can imagine, I hope, my absolute astonishment at these words. Baffled by the nature of his enigmatic puzzles as I was, the idea of the Trefusis of all people that I knew, promising to attempt contact with the living, well, it simply horrified me. Ghosts? He was fiercely, almost brutally opposed to the kind of talk that calls itself spiritual, yet deals in abstracts, fantasy, and that which people want to be true. I remember him so well saying this to me. I even wrote it down in a notebook so as not to forget it. Learning, curiosity, commitment and enthusiasm for the truth are all you need to enable the mind to travel through time and space, to cast wide the doors of the infinite, to brush the cheeks of the immortals, to commune with the dead, to fly unimpeded across the centuries, to be one with the greatest and most remarkable. Discipline, understanding, work, investigation, scholarship, and a passionate commitment to what is are the keys to unlocking these mysteries. Moaning with crystals, fermenting herbs, gazing at constellations whose composition you do not understand, closing your eyes in a trance and wishing, these are the strategies of the lazy, the gullible and the insecure, led by the greedy, the cruel and the fraudulent. The truth is out there, everything, free and available. It only asks of you that you are curious, that you have an appetite for knowledge and understanding. Well, can it now be that he, like poor Conan Doyle before him, had ended his life as the kind of self-deluded fool who believed that he could return as a dead spirit and communicate with the living and through a micro-blogging service? As if, I mean, as if. But there is a little more to be heard from that first sound file, and then you will know as much as I.
So, there we have it. Welcome to the path. Welcome to the quest. Call it what you will. We will travel together across time by way of all kinds, sorts and conditions of things and people. As we gather our clues on the way, perhaps we will pick things up that will make us richer. The technical word for pick things up that make you richer is learn. Perhaps we will learn things. I do hope so. You must now make it your business, Stephen, to knock what I have said into some sort of shape that can cause me to be disseminated through the channels and pipelines to which you have access. Until the next stage on the path, listen out for the twitterings of my ghost. So I say, if you have been, bless you.
And there you have it. I will leave you to make sense of it all. Perhaps the third installment will make things plainer. You've been listening to Stephen Fry's The Dongle of Donald Trefusis.